Outsourcing and global companies like Walmart have changed the picture for American labor. My guest, Andy Stern, is trying to respond to that. He's president of the Service Employees International Union, the largest union in the U.S. Last year, as the AFL-CIO was celebrating its 50th anniversary, he led his union out of the AFL, along with the Teamsters and unions representing food and commercial workers, carpenters, and farm workers. Stern founded a new federation called Change to Win. Stern also chairs Walmart Watch, which describes its mission as studying the impact of large corporations on society and challenging Walmart to become a better employer and corporate citizen. Stern has written a new book called A Country That Works. Andy Stern, welcome to Fresh Air. So let's cut right to the chase here. Why did you break away from the AFL?
Well, there was a context, Terry, for the decision. I had spent 10 years of my life trying to change the AFL-CIO to be a more modern 21st century organization. And for the last 10 years and many years before, every day of my life, I was part of an organization that was growing smaller and not stronger. But more importantly, I was watching what was happening to American workers. Productivity was increasing, but workers' wages were not. Corporate profits were up. People's health care and retirement were down. And we were walking down a road, and you really could tell where it ended. And the end was not going to be good for American workers. So when you're walking down a road and you know where it ends, you get off the road and you walk in a new direction where there's hope. Leaving the AFL was certainly not an accomplishment. It's simply an opportunity to do something for American workers.
One of the things that you've said about the AFL is that you didn't think it acknowledged labor's complicity in its own failings. Like what?
Well, in order to grow, you have to reach out to people that are not part of your organization. You know, I've said at times, and this is somewhat of a caricature, but you know, that the labor movement was a little bit too male and too pale and too stale, and we're not really reaching out to people in the new workforce, in the service industries, women, people of color, and immigrants. And so, you know, part of our problem was not being a welcoming organization. A second was not spending the kind of money we needed to bring new workers into our organizations. And finally, you know, we were very focused on the leaders and not the members. You know, and therefore we had an organization that really was not dynamic and change-oriented, but it was really trying to preserve too much of the status quo.
So which unions left with you to form the Federation Change to Win?
There are seven unions altogether. The largest is our union, SEIU, which is mostly health care, building and property service workers and public workers, the Teamsters Union, the United Food and Commercial Workers, who represent a lot of the workers in the grocery stores in America, the Laborers and Carpenters Unions, which are construction unions, and the United Farm Workers Union, Cesar Chavez's union, out in California.
You've said we're not going to organize employees one store at a time. We have to organize across industries and companies. What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is I think sometimes we forgot as a union movement that our employers live in a competitive environment, and somehow we thought we could show up at one store and raise wages or for one company and raise wages, and yet then that makes those employers less competitive. So what we realize is the way that we can provide a more positive relationship with our employers is to organize, you know, whole markets or whole industries. You know, for example, if you go to New York City or Philadelphia, all the janitors in all the buildings make the same amount of money and have the same benefits, which means the employers aren't competing about who can pay the less, but they're competing about who can be more efficient and who can manage better and who can introduce new technology. So what the union has done is sort of leveled the playing field, stabilized the workforce, then allow employers to be successful on the right kind of values. And when you only represent one building, you know, what you would find is you would raise the wages of those janitors very high, and then someone would come in and undercut by bidding that job at a lower wage and benefit level. And so to be good partners with our employers, we have a role to play, which is to make competition fair. And that's what a new and modern labor movement needs to do.
So give me an example of a field that you think could be organized in this way.
Well, I think right now we're trying to organize security officers in America. Mm-hmm. There are 2 million security officers. It's actually the largest organizing drive for African Americans, and particularly African American men, in urban areas in the United States. They work in office buildings, sometimes the same office buildings as janitors who work for the same companies and the same owners, and yet the security officers are actually making less wages and benefits than the janitors, even though clearly they have more responsibility, and that's because they don't have a union. But rather than going to one company, Securitas or Wackenhut, and asking that they raise wages and benefits, you know, we're going to a market like Los Angeles or Philadelphia or Washington, D.C., and talking to all the owners about how in a post-9/11 world we can professionalize the industry, we can stabilize the turnover, we can work with the police departments to integrate security. So we're trying to be much more modern, much more thoughtful, much more value-added, and at the same time make sure that workers who are guarding these, you know, multi-million and sometimes billion-dollar buildings, you know, share in the success of what has been a prosperous industry.
So how much success are you having?
Well, so far we've seen a lot of good results. We're seeing in cities like Chicago, Minneapolis, Seattle, people forming unions and bargaining contracts that are changing their lives. In cities like Los Angeles, we're very close to having a first citywide agreement. In New York City, there are 5,000 more security officers who will be in a union this year. But more importantly, what we're seeing is people change their lives. You know, Marvin Parker is one of the reasons I wrote this book. You know, he is a security officer who's been guarding buildings and diamond stores, in fact, in New York City. He's worked in as a security officer for 9 years, and he makes $7 an hour. In the 9 years, he's gotten one raise of 25 cents an hour. And Marvin right now, sadly, has an eye infection. He can't afford to go to the doctor to get it treated because he can't afford the cost of a doctor because he has no health care. He says, even if I went to the doctor, then I'd have to get medication. I don't have enough money to buy the medication, and to add insult to injury, he has no sick leave, so in order to get to the doctor, he'd have to take a day off from work. So he's self-medicating. Now, this is the richest country on earth, and he works in a very responsible job, and he's done it for 9 years to the best of his ability, and yet he is now risking his health because his employer isn't paying the kind of wages he needs to take care of himself, and he doesn't have health care. That's not the America we want or we need, and that's why this security organizing and all of the work we're trying to do is to make sure that everyone shares in the success of a growing economy, not just the shareholders and the executives.
One of the issues that workers are dealing with now is that a lot of jobs have been outsourced to other countries, including a lot of service positions. And one of the things you want to do is organize global unions. Can you give us a sense of what kind of model you'd like to see?
Well, I think, you know, just like the first companies who tried to create, you know, multinational corporations, you know, we're sort of trying to stagger forward, you know, make progress. You know, what we know is very simple. It used to be workers of the world unite was somewhat of an ideological question. And we had this great struggle between communism and socialism and capitalism. You know, and now what we have is instead of those kind of conflicts, we see that workers in the United States and workers in Canada and Mexico, South Africa and Indonesia, Korea, who get up every day and walk for Walmart, actually have the same employer. And all of a sudden we're finding not a struggle ideologically, but an opportunity in terms of workers of the world working for the same employers, trying to come together and be able to change their lives. And we now have done a series of efforts around the world with other unions, particularly in the security and the cleaning and food service industry, where people that work for the same companies are beginning to approach their employers in a common fashion. Someday you would hope that that would lead to global unions, that it wouldn't be a coalition or a confederation. There would actually be real integration so that those workers belong to the same organization, not to deal with issues about their country's politics or cultural issues, but issues about work. And I think that's the direction we're going. People who work in the same companies, people who work in the same industry, need to belong to the same organization. And now that capital has gone global, trade has gone global, and companies have gone global, unions have to go global as well.
Boy, it seems like there'd be a lot of obstacles to organizing that, because a lot of the countries that the jobs have migrated to don't have the kind of democracies in which unions are likely to thrive. Take China, for instance, in which a lot of jobs have been, a lot of companies have moved there, a lot of jobs have moved there. What are the odds of forming active labor unions in an authoritarian country like China?
Well, first of all, if America keeps moving in the direction it has recently in some of the Bush NLRB rulings, which are taking more and more rights away from people like nurses to be able to have their own organization, you begin to wonder what kind of democracy we're going to have. In China, The truth is they actually have better labor laws than they do in the United States on paper. The truth is also that they are a part of the government, the unions, historically. But as the market economy is beginning to come into place, the Chinese unions are faced with a problem that the government is not their employer anymore, as it once was when everything was owned by the party and run by the party. Now we have huge multinational corporations. Almost every Fortune 500 company is now in China. And these workers are saying, well, I can't go and complain to the government. I actually have to go to deal with these multinational companies, and it's been pretty frustrating. And we were involved with the Chinese unions trying to work with them to organize Walmart. And it's somewhat ironic that the first unionized Walmart store I ever went into was in Shenzhen, China, and not anywhere in the United States. So I think it is a problem in terms of the history of China. It has not changed significantly. But you can see the seeds of change as multinational companies come in and workers of the world confront the fact, you know, they can't raise their wages, you know, simply on their own. They need organizations, and at times they're going to need a global organization as well.
So what was the union that the Walmart workers were organized in?
Well, there's only one union in China. It's called the ACFTU. It's been there, written into the Constitution since 1925. It really was, as it's called itself for a long time, a transmission belt between the party and the workers. But that was in the communist-dominated state-owned enterprise era, and now we have a different era. And I think what happens to the Chinese Union are enormously important. They have 140 million members in their organization that pay dues. It is not the kind of union, I'd say, yet, you know, that any of us think is the right level of activity. But the point is it's changing, and it's important that it changes in a way that it becomes an independent force for the workers in dealing with those employers, because multinational companies are rushing to China, and it's a race to the bottom, and they are at least a force that could raise wages and benefits.
Walmart is the world's largest private employer, and you chair a group called Walmart Watch. What's the purpose of this group?
Of the 100 largest economies in the world, 52 are companies, 48 are countries. Walmart is the 31st, which means that the sales of Walmart are greater than the gross domestic product of Ireland or Singapore or Venezuela. This is a huge corporation, $300 billion. And yet, its business model is not only low prices, but really now more and more part-time workers, low wages, and very little benefits. In fact, it's hard to believe, but Walmart just came out with a new policy that caps the wages of its long-term workers, all of which is just trying to force them out so they can hire lower-wage workers. It requires about 40% of its workers now to be not only part-time, but be available to work any shift, which means if you're a mother with daycare needs, it's impossible to be able to do that. Or if you want to make a plan to go to church on Sunday with your family, you're at Walmart's disposal if they decide they need to change the shifts. And what they're looking for is the most flexible and disposable workforce. And then on top of that, if their employees get sick, you know, Terry, you and I are going to end up paying for their health care because Walmart has the largest number of people on tax-funded health care plans state by state. I mean, the five members of the Walton family, and I'm sure they're decent people, they have $19 billion each. They get $500 million each from George Bush from his dividend tax cut. I mean, this is not going to build a great American economy, you know, when five people, you know, make a fortune and the people that work there are now being told you have to pay $13 for your new khaki pants that are going to be part of your new uniform at Walmart, that we're not even going to provide you with that. I mean, this is going to make America the kind of country that really becomes two-tier. And I think it's wrong, and I'm working with other people to try to change it.
So are you trying to unionize Walmart?
We're not. The purpose of our group, which combines unions and community organizations, women's and civil rights groups, is really about changing Walmart's business model. Unions would be a way to do it, but there are many other ways in the 21st century to get a company's attention and to try to have them act in a much more responsible fashion.
You know, I was reading a book about how politics have changed and are changing. And one of the observations in the book is that, you know, it used to be that if you're running for office, you wanted to win the labor vote because it's a big voting bloc. And now it's about values. People vote their values. And I wonder what your reaction to that is, and if you think that there's that the way some people cast it, the whole idea of like winning the labor vote seems outdated.
Well, I think that every voter in their minds is weighing a number of factors. You know, whether it's your feelings about the particular candidate, whether it's economic issues that are troubling you, whether it's social issues, war, terrorism. I think we're all complicated people. You know, what we find is for union members, when we talk to them about the issues of work and where candidates stand on health care or retirement, you know, people make their own decisions and they tend to vote for people that serve their interest.
You're a union organizer who, as you point out in your own book, does not have stories about growing up in a union family. You grew up in a family of lawyers?
Well, my dad's a lawyer. My mom, as was custom of her time, raised her kids before she went back to work. And I have two brothers and a sister who are lawyers.
So how did you get into a union?
Well, I wish it was an important story. The truth was I had been doing a lot of part-time work, and I finally got what was then a very good job working for the state of Pennsylvania and as a social service worker. And I noticed on the bulletin board that they were having a union meeting to discuss the first contract. And what really interested me, because I didn't have a lot of money at the time, was they were serving pizza. So my union career begins with going to eat pizza and then being the last one in the room when the final issue on the agenda was the election of the assistant shop steward of the Vine District Welfare Office. And in a trick that I used many times after that, I was the last one in the room and the shop steward nominated me and elected me by acclamation, and that's how I began my union career.
This is a kind of personal question, but one of the things that you write about in your book, A Country That Works, is the fact that your daughter, when she was, I think, 13, died in part because she had scoliosis, which is curvature of the spine, and she'd had some surgery to relieve that. And her death was related to the surgery and to another medical problem that she had. In your job as a labor organizer, you know, and the head of a union, you're not working 9 to 5. You're working night and day and weekends probably. And I'm wondering how that kind of personal tragedy affected your sense of, you know, work versus family.
Well, you know, the one thing I'm really glad for, you know, is that I don't look back and say, you know, I didn't spend enough time with my daughter or my son. You know, I write in the book about how, you know, we traveled together to Africa and to Italy and places around the country. We spent an incredible amount of time together. And, you know, in the end, I don't know what I'd do if I felt like I had sacrificed my family for my job. And I just think it's enormously important. We create a country, you know, where people, you know, aren't sort of passing their partners like ships in the night or in the driveway, you know, tag you're it, no tag you're it in terms of childcare and other responsibilities. So I was glad I got that opportunity, and I miss her desperately. And she is, as I say in my book, you know, the courage that I have now to be much more fearless about fighting for what I think is right, because I've faced the greatest tragedy, the most horrible nightmare I could have imagined. I barely made it through it. You know, my union family and my own family, thank God, were there, you know, for me. And now I feel like I have a responsibility to her and to her memory, you know, to live with a kind of courage about doing what's right so that other people can get time with their kids and at least have the opportunity to do the best they can to raise their family and live the American dream.
Well, Andy Stern, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Andy Stern is the president of the Service Employees International Union and a founder of the new labor federation Change to Win. His new book is called A Country That Works.